Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of A Stab in the Dark, the UK TV podcast that investigates the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama. It puts them in a cell for the night, gives them a damn good kicking, because it's just a metaphor and, you know, things like that don't actually happen anymore, then finds out what they've got to say for themselves the next morning. My name's Mark Billingham, and today, in our interview room, we welcome two of the UK's best and most critically acclaimed crime writers. Sarah Hillary is a former winner of the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year Award, as is Belinda Bauer, who somewhat greedily is also the winner of the CWA Gold Dagger for her first novel, no less. In this episode, I'll be talking to Belinda and Sarah about their careers, their writing styles, their characters, and whatever else takes our fancy. Plus, we'll be taking a closer look at small screen favourite Luther, starting on UK TV this month. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. So, Belinda and Sarah, welcome to the podcast, to our sumptuously appointed interview room, where the biscuit, you're already digging into the biscuits. So let's get important questions out of the way first. Sarah, biscuit of choice?
Oh, gosh, that's a different one. Hobnob.
A hobnob?
Anything chocolate.
Anything chocolate. No, see, no, neither of you going like for the chocolates. King of biscuits, which is just the McVitie's Digestive.
Oh, that is a cool,
that is a good one.
Isn't
that? That is it cool is a good one.
Cheese on it if you want to go savoury, yeah. And it's the best dunker.
Yeah, it is. They've got a caramel version now, actually.
Oh, that's the work of the devil.
You'd think it would be, but it's surprisingly good.
Okay, well, down to business. Enough talk about biscuits. Now, you've both had books out this year, or certainly within the past year. So let's talk a little bit about them. Belinda, now, you've left your pet iguana back in Wales to be with us today. I'm going to be coming back to the iguana. But firstly, tell us a little bit about The Beautiful Dead.
The Beautiful Dead is set in South London and is about a TV reporter, Eve Singer, who sort of like has to try and hang on to her job by reporting murder and mayhem all over the city. And a serial killer starts to go to work and starts to enlist her as his publicity machine. So begins to perform his what he likes to call his exhibitions, specifically for her to report upon.
Now, you've been a reporter, so did you draw on your own experiences writing this one?
Not immediate experiences.
You've never come across a serial killer, then?
No, not personally, but I think you do draw on the experience of every day confronting the fine moral line that you have to tread. To keep all the balls in the air. You're on both sides of the divide at the same time very often as a reporter. You're talking to the police, you're talking to the criminals. So, you know, it was a very interesting period of my life and it was really nice to revisit it in this book.
Was it hard to stay detached from some of these fairly awful things you must have been involved with as a journalist?
I think when you go into a situation as a journalist with that remit, then it is quite easy to stay detached. And I think that's where the fascination comes from. So you don't, you know, I would go into prison sometimes and interview prisoners who'd done terrible things. But you, because you're there with an agenda, you don't become personally involved in it. You are just asking them the questions that will elicit the answers that you require. And so it's quite easy to remain detached and only look at it in hindsight and be full of awe that you spoke to this person who did this thing and managed to actually not clock them one.
Showing admirable restraint. I just do have to come back to the iguana.
It's
briefly.
A chameleon.
Is it a chameleon?
It's a chameleon.
Oh, we should shoot the researchers. It's a chameleon. Not that I'd know the difference. If I saw a chameleon and iguana on the table, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you the difference. Chameleon's the one that changes colour,
that changes
right?
colour, yes.
Okay, and what does a chameleon eat?
Crickets, flies, spiders, any kind of insects.
And do they
really
get them themselves or do you have to provide them for your
during
chameleon?
The winter you provide them and...
What, you go online and you
well,
buy...
You can get them through the post and in fact...
Whoa,
when
stop.
I...
What? Dead fly?
No, it has to be alive.
Right, so the postman is delivering you live insects.
That's right, yes. I had a chameleon many years ago, and there was a postal strike, and my crickets didn't arrive. And I went to the sorting office and said, "Listen, I've got live crickets, and I need them." And they said, they opened a door at the back of the sorting office, a huge warehouse full of undelivered boxes, and they said, "Help yourself." And I walked straight over to the box where the crickets were chirping like crazy. I said, "I'll have that one, please."
Oh, my Lord. Sarah, your protagonist, D.I. Marnie Rome, is back this year with another story with a fairly intense and complicated plot, family story. Tell us a bit about that.
It begins with a series of vigilante attacks in London, which the Marnie and the team that are doing the investigating realise quite quickly are... being that the victims of these vigilante attacks were in fact themselves at one time or other found guilty of vicious or violent attacks themselves. They'd all served prison time, but perhaps not as much prison time as they should have done. They got short sentences, or it happened when they were quite young. Once they've made that connection, then they're hunting the vigilante, or more than one vigilante they suspect. And at the same time, there's a burglary at Marnie's family home, which 6 years ago was a crime scene, because that's where her foster brother Stephen murdered her parents. And it's now she rents the house out because she isn't quite ready yet to sell it or to give it up, because she's always suspected that it might somehow hold the secret, the reason why this 14-year-old foster boy committed these terrible murders. And there's a burglary there, and her tenants are hospitalised. And then they discover that a shoebox was taken that had been very, very well hidden in the house. And Marnie realises that actually this is a very personal crime, and the shoebox contains things of hers that only Stephen could have hidden. So she begins to realise that there's this latest spate of attacks seems somehow to be revolving around her and her past.
Right. Well, yeah. So when we first met Marnie in the first book, obviously there's this trauma that is defining her. This is the fourth one. So how do you feel that she's sort of progressed and developed? And is it important that she,
it's really important that she's changed. Yeah. I think I hate those long-running series where these people that are witnessing terrible things, the worst of humanity on a daily basis.
Yeah, they just pick themselves up
exactly
like it's never
the
happened.
Same people. But interestingly, I found I don't like to reread my own stuff. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I find myself really quite... I tend not to do that. I'll listen to it on audiobook, maybe, because it feels like a different story if it's someone else is reading it. But when I reread Someone Else's Skin recently, I was surprised at how sort of prickly and quite unpleasant Marnie was. And I think as the series progresses, she's becoming softer, which is actually her way of becoming stronger. So I found that quite interesting, because I didn't set out to do it that way, because I don't plot the series or the books. But she was definitely... She's now able to make herself vulnerable to people in the way that she definitely couldn't at the beginning of the series.
Right.
Which is, feels quite dangerous to her to do that. But it's part of her journey.
And why London? Books are set in London. You don't live in London.
Not.
So why did you choose the city?
Well, I lived in London for several years before I moved out. And really what it was I'd always wanted to write a book set in or around Battersea Power Station. And I finally got to do that with the third book in the series.
Why were you so obsessed with...
fascinated with Battersea Power Station. I can't explain it really, other than it's... At the time that I was first obsessed with it, I was living in London. I used to ride in and out of London on the train and past Battersea. And I always loved it. It looked so huge then, like a big upturned table with those massive chimneys. And I became quite obsessed with it at one time. And then I went back to look at it, because I realised I wrote the first draft of Taste Like Fear, the third book, set, and the opening crime scene is set within Battersea Power Station. And they're actually completely, they're developing it over into luxury penthouses now. Yeah. Sting's bought one of the penthouses.
Oh, I see. Oh, God bless him. Now, a lot of people kind of associate the countryside with more the sort of cozier end of crime. You know, old Mrs. Johnson's jam's been nicked at the Fate, or whatever. That's me generalising horrendously about cozy rural crime. But your books are anything but cozy. So why the countryside for you?
Really, I like to set books places where I've been and that I know reasonably well. I think that's kind of important for me to be able to give a sense of authenticity. When we first moved back to Britain from South Africa, where I spent a lot of my formative years, we moved to North Devon, And so I had a very interesting sort of transitional period there, where we'd gone from being pretty, you know, well-off people to being extremely poor, and seeing poverty for the first time in my life, you know, as somebody who was suddenly plunged into it, was really interesting for me. Not at the time, obviously, yeah. But by the time I came to write a book, it was an experience that I really felt able to draw upon. Plus, I really like that juxtaposition between the very cozy scenery, the beauty, the smallness of somewhere like Exmoor, which is where the first three books were set, and murder. I think it's an interesting place to go, especially if you don't go down the cozy route.
Yeah.
You know, if you use that juxtaposition to enhance the horror of a crime like murder.
But then by the time of Rubbernecker, which won just about every award going as far as I can remember, you're in the big bad city of Cardiff.
Yes.
So what differences did you find in terms of, I mean, there's obvious differences in the landscape, but how did those differences affect the story and the characters, do you think?
I don't know if they really did. I think that every story has the perfect place to take place. And when I start to think about a story, when I get the first idea, the first question I ask myself is, who's the best person to tell this story and where's the best place for it to happen? And that's when I start to think about all the places I've been in my life, all the places I've seen in my life, where, you know, would that be a suitable location for this story to take place? And if it's somewhere that I'm not that familiar with, I'll go there and actually stay there for a little while, and so I get a real flavour for the place.
I mean, I suppose you must agree, Sarah, that London, I think London's a perfect place to set a crime novel in, as in any big city would be. I've always had an issue with the countryside. It's just a strange bias I have. I just hear the tune from the Arches and start to tremble. Because I'm sure, obviously, all sorts of terrible things happen in the countryside. But in somewhere like London, it seems to me that you've got the best of both worlds, because you've got this sort of glamorous, sort of glamorous facade and a tourist-friendly thing, but then you've got this sort of underbelly. I guess you get that in any
Definitely.
Big city.
Yes, I think so. And I think I like the idea that I think you can be anonymous in the city in the way that you can't. I've lived in the countryside. I absolutely... Oh, it nearly drove me mad, I
that
tell
everybody
you.
Knows everybody else's
everybody
business.
Everybody knows everybody else's business. There's not actually... the part of the countryside where I lived in was the sort of Cotswolds, so it was basically the suburbs of the suburbs of the suburbs of Birmingham. And certainly our immediate neighbours were Brummies, which is quite funny.
Cause Steady now, I'm a Brummie.
But there were things like...
Before you go down that route.
They were lovely people. There were things like you're not allowed to put your washing out at the in your own garden because the tourists might want to come past and see your beautiful backyard, and how dare you have your knickers hanging up. So there's that. But I think what I like about the... And it's not to say people can't keep secrets in the countryside, because obviously they can, but I think in the city, I really do feel a big city is just bristling with secrets. I think, you know, there's so much diversity, so many pockets of people that you can completely slip between the cracks. That's what the third book was about. It was about people that become homeless and then just become lost. And I think that absolutely, I believe that's true in a city. You can just vanish off the face of the earth, as
and
it
you,
were.
And you can confront issues like, you know, the multi-ethnic makeup
yes,
of a city
can.
And stuff, which is not really the case in the countryside.
No,
is
but
it?
In the countryside's defence here, I have to say that although there are fewer people and fewer secrets, possibly, those secrets have deeper roots.
Yeah.
Because you have many generations, possibly, of people and histories that have to be uncovered. And whereas in the city, you're dealing with a far more sort of transient population in a lot of cases. And so I think they both have their part to play. And I'm really pleased that I did come away from Exmoor before the whole Midsummer Murders plague took hold of me and actually started to set books just where I fancied them and where I thought the story would work best.
Yeah, if you keep writing mystery set in the countryside, eventually you will have a character who's killed by a large cheese for them. I mean, that is...
They do. They roll them, don't they?
It's yeah, and somebody will be killed by
but
a large
know, the cello
rolling
play,
cheese.
You know, the cello player of the ELO was killed by a giant rolling haystack.
Shut the front door. What are you talking about?
He was driving in his car. This happened about 2 years ago. I'm amazed you don't know about it.
No, I know. I'm shocked.
He was driving in his car, and one of those enormous round haystacks rolled out of a field, jumped the hedge, and crushed him to death.
My God. The countryside is much more dangerous
it
than
is
any
dangerous.
Of us realise.
No, that's true. No, that is absolutely true. Oh, yeah. That's an awful way to go.
It's
not that there's a nice way to go.
Well, I mean, you know what? My family always say, die, but don't die stupid.
I'm imagining conversations at the police station. How did he die? Giant haystacks. What, the wrestler? Yes. No, no, he was actually killed by a giant haystack. Okay, well, we've got Belinda there slightly sticking up for rural crime and Sarah defending urban crime. Now, since we are talking about city-based noir, or we have been, UK TV Channel W is showing the fourth series of Luther next week, and I think it's pretty much the best series, well, certainly for a long time, that's been set in London. Now, I know you're a huge fan of,
yes,
of the show. So what melts your butter about Luther? Well, apart from Mr. Elba.
Well, yes, obviously. oddly enough, I didn't like it when it first started, you know.
Okay.
I watched the first two episodes and I thought, I did that thing that I never thought I would be the person doing. It's the kind of thing that if my mother watched crime, she would have done, which was to go, the police wouldn't behave like that. That's unreasonable, you know. He's not a proper detective. Why is he being? And then around about episode three, I realised it's basically it's Batman. It's a superhero series set that happens to be set in and around a police force. It's not actually meant to be remotely. And once I'd realised that, I just was away. I just loved what they did with it after that. And it did have moments where it became very realistic. I mean, that the series, whichever series it was, where Nicola Walker was in it, where she played the wife, brilliant. But it always retained this sort of epic graphic novel sort of quality.
It was very sort of grand guignol, and not naturalistic at all, actually.
No. Once you'd realised it wasn't trying to be, and it didn't want to be, and it didn't need to be, then I think it was just, it became a real heroic quest, the sort of flawed hero pitting himself against the world. And great characters, amazing writing, London looking just fantastic. The way it's lit, the way it's, you know, you really do feel that you're watching a sort of legendary piece of sort of epic cinema rather than a gritty, realistic TV.
Oh,
that's
my
great.
Goodness, I have obviously completely missed the boat.
Yeah, you need to watch it.
You've just completely sold me.
Yeah.
I need to watch this.
But what Sarah says is interesting, I think, that idea that when you first watch a lot of these cop shows and you'll go, oh, that's ridiculous, that would never happen. Probably the same degree people say that about our books.
Absolutely, yes.
But I do think there are things that happen in some TV cop shows that we could never get away with.
Yes.
I mean, everybody was gripped by Line of Duty. I loved Line of Duty, but it's preposterous.
Absolutely
preposterous in terms of what the police would be doing. But
who hangs a tracksuit on a coat hanger?
Absolutely.
This is my major problem.
I'm fairly convinced you can't operate anything that needs a fingerprint using severed fingers.
I don't think you can.
I think there needs to be blood to the severed fingers
use it. You're honing in on the much more, the proper police procedure. I was more obsessed with why a man who is virtually bald had an enormous paddle-shaped hairbrush.
No, that's the first thing my wife picked up on as well. So that's ridiculous.
Hair. And also, the whole point of his character was that he was sort of OCD, but absolutely obsessed with hygiene and, you know, all of this stuff. And yet he had this massive hairbrush full of his own hair. He just
sounds to me as though he brushed the hair clean out of his head.
He did. I think he might have done. But yes, I think, and because we'd liked that, you see, that's a series that I liked because it was so realistic in the early days.
Yeah.
And I did believe it. I thought it did have the ring of truth about it. So when they then went to the, you know, the preposterous end of the scale, I felt quite cross because I knew they could do it. I felt like they'd let themselves down.
But it's got more and more popular as it's got more and more preposterous, which is an interesting thing. I mean, why do you think viewers will put up with more, let's say, non-realism than they will, than readers will?
I think if it's a good show to start with, they get invested in it and they just stick with it.
Yeah. I think they like the twists. And it delivers the twists all the time. It's only afterwards that you stop and think, was that a realistic twist?
Yes.
And maybe they don't ever stop and think, is that a realistic twist? Our job is to discover whether something's a realistic twist.
We're always viewing like we're always reading as writers, aren't we? So it makes us hypercritical. So probably the worst viewers for a show like that.
Well, just before we go to our little mini featurette, we're going to have a break in a minute. But just before we do that, I'm going to pin you down now. There's a very nice quote from a Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Copper Beeches. The lowest and vilest valleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling and beautiful countryside. So I'm now going to actually put you on the spot and you have to choose. Firstly, as a reader, and then as a writer, a rural setting or an urban setting? Belinda.
I think rural.
As a reader?
Yes.
You like reading stuff set in the countryside?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, there has to be fate and duck racing. We're going to get hate mail from
rural listeners now. I'm interested in the characters more than I'm interested in the plot or the setting, first and foremost. And I think possibly a rural setting allows somebody to investigate characters more deeply. because there's not so much going on.
But you'll set your books anywhere. What comes
I'll
first is the
anywhere.
Character and the story
yeah.
for you.
Yeah, I actually slightly so I have a slight preference for writing in a rural setting.
Okay.
My book I'm writing at the moment is in a rural setting.
You see, I tell you what's interesting is one of the reasons I can't write in a rural setting is I have no eye for landscape. You tend to know what you're good at and bad at as a writer.
Yes.
And I know that I cannot describe a landscape. I could stare at trees in a sky for an hour and I wouldn't be able to describe it.
So interesting, because I felt the same way a little bit. I felt a little bit handicapped writing The Beautiful Dead. Not so much Rubbernecker, which was set in Cardiff, but The Beautiful Dead. I really felt like I had been too long away from the city to write, to set a book in London.
What about you, Sarah? Rural or urban?
Well, you see, you can't beat Blacklands for, you know, that use of Exmoor in that book, and the chase as well across the moors, that hunt, that game of cat and mouse that is played at the end of that book, is, you know, just brilliant, and I love it. So, and I've read some books set in London that aren't exciting. And that are, so I do think you're right. I think it all comes back to character. So I think if the character, I'm actually forcing Marnie in book 5 that I'm writing at the moment, I'm forcing her to leave London.
Oh, where's she going to go?
Yeah, you know, and a friend of mine said to me, that's interesting. So what are you going to be claiming back on your deductible, reason? And where have you sent her? He said, Thailand, is it, you know, and I said, it's Cumbria. But she's got a new boss who's a northerner, and I'm from the north, so I grew up just south of Manchester, so actually I know that part of the world very well. And I just wanted to, but I found it very tedious. It was the 4 hours up the motorway that I found really tedious, and I was determined not to write the road trip because I just didn't want to do that. But I just thought, how do you justify a London cop leaving, going for four? Why not just leave it to the local police? And so it became quite difficult to do. And then when they were there, I did like playing how different darkness the night is in the countryside versus London, because London never gets dark. A big city never gets properly dark. You've got light pollution, you've got, you know, and so, but when you're in the countryside, and the countryside isn't quiet either, like people think it is, because you hear all the animals at night, don't you? I've lived there long enough.
It's making me shiver. That's what I don't like.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear animals at night. The odd fox I can handle, but.
At least you know police sirens, helicopters, you know, all of those noises are fine in a city, but sometimes when you hear those animals just scurrying in the, you know, so I wanted to get a kind of creepy and contrast that with the, you know, the silence and the dark in the countryside versus the quality of silence that you get in a city.
Yeah.
I found quite interesting to
it's
do.
It's only one book though, right? You're not going to leave her up there.
No, I'm not. No, she's back already in the chapter, at the end of the same chapter, more or less. So,
oh, okay. It was so, just a chapter?
It was a couple of chapters. It was one interview that she
Mom,
has.
Oh, relieved. Yeah.
I know.
I have.
There
that.
You go. Yeah, it's okay.
How much? You've put her through enough already.
I know. I thought so. I thought it was cruel. But at least Noah got to stay at home in the city. He didn't have to be subjected to Kendall and Keswick.
Oh, it's mint cake. Did Molly have any mint cake?
She didn't. Oh, do you know what? She didn't. She should have had some mint cake.
Of course she should.
It made it all worthwhile.
It's the only reason to go up there.
Yeah.
I didn't say that, listeners.
No.
That was Belinda Bauer who said that. Now, we'll be talking to Belinda and Sarah a lot more after this little break, which means it's time for our regular feature in which a Stab in the Dark's roving reporter and the man with the spyglass, Paul Hirons, delves a little deeper into the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama. It's over to you.
Yes, thanks, Mark. Now, since we've been talking about Luther, I thought I'd try and get the inside track on the show. So I have Euston Films, head of Euston Films, Kate Harwood with me. And of course, Kate, of course, appeared in the very first episode of A Stab in the Dark last year and was head of BBC Drama when Luther first came into being. So, Kate, welcome back to A Stab in the Dark.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I'm interested, what was the pitch for Luther back in the day, and what were your kind of first impressions of the show?
Well, I met Neil for the first time, and he was already quite known because he'd been writing on Spooks, and he pitched us a show about a kind of introspective and quite brilliant detective. But with Neil, the first pitch actually was going to be a serial. In other words, it's going to be 6 episodes of one quite big story. And I remember that we looked at it and said, you know, he's such a powerful character as described and sort of there at that pitch stage. We'd love to find individual stories of the week. And so Neil went away and came back with a treatment with 6 stories of the week that formed the first series. And where it started was a you know, a compelling charismatic detective and a compelling and charismatic serial killer. And they, of course, that was Alice and Luther, and they met in episode one. But that, the plan from the off was not to develop that relationship and those two characters in the way that they then went on to be developed. But that's another part of the story.
Obviously, you mentioned the actors, and I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because during the episode that we have been talking through, we had a couple of guests, Sarah Hillary, the crime writer, and Belinda Bauer. And Sarah said something really, really interesting. Luther reminds her of a graphic novel in lots of many ways. Is that something that you were kind of aiming for in the development? Would you agree with that, first of all?
I don't think it's sort of aiming for quite so specifically in development. I think that Bill writes with a slightly heightened sense of the world. This is not grim and gritty, you know, truth, and, you know, documentary drama. This is someone who's looking around his world and can just kind of heighten it enough to sort of see context in a way. And Brian Kirk, who directed the first block of Luther, was talking about a particular shot to Neil and said, Neil quotes it quite often and said, I'm trying to frame Luther to the side of the picture because that's where you're going to put the speech bubble. So he was paying a little bit of an homage to the idea of Luther as a character for a graphic novel.
Now, you know, any chat about Luther can't be a chat about Luther if you don't talk about Idris in the lead role. And he's such a huge presence in that lead role. Was Idris always the number one target for the show, do you think?
No, not at all. No, I mean, you know, the one request when we started was you've got to find a leading man. Now, you'd think that'd be easy, but actually when you're casting television drama in Britain, you know, lead men are thin on the ground, to be honest. The British actors are hugely in demand. You find a lot of our leading male actors are in Hollywood. And, you know, quite often a lot of the more character actors, you know, work across both. But actually, it's quite hard to find leading men. And I think he wasn't literally the first person that came up, but he was one of the first people that came up. And, you know, he wasn't hugely known here at the time. I mean, I think to the coterie and the cool, people knew him from The Wire, but I think he'd finished on The Wire some time before, but he was kind of doing bits and bobs. And basically, as soon as his name came up, there was an absolute, everybody kind of went, oh, yes, clearly a leading man, very masculine, very charismatic, you know, very handsome. You know, how could we possibly go wrong? Now, of course, sometimes one does go wrong, but we were very, very lucky. And Idris completely made that role his own. And it meant a lot to him as well, I think. You know, I mean, I've heard him, he said that to me, and he said that in public, that it was a role that gave him a lot back. And that's always the sort of symbiosis you hope for with an actor, where they get something out of it and you get something out of it. So it's been a, you know, very intense relationship between Neil and Idris over many years now.
And it's going to continue. You know, we had the announcement yesterday, which is really interesting obviously as Idris's profile has grown and his work, his kind of portfolio of work has grown globally, he's become linked with all kinds of fantastic characters. So it's great news that it's coming back in 2018. Thanks so much for joining us again, Kate. And with that, it's back to you in the studio, Mark.
Thanks, Paul, and you can watch Luther on W starting on Sunday the 25th of June at 10 p.m. Now, Belinda and Sarah, I want to talk to you both a bit more about characters and characterisation. You both write characters that are incredibly vulnerable in some way. Is that vulnerability important? Sarah, you touched on it earlier, Marnie's vulnerability.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the way into a character for the reader as well as the writer. I think it makes them really interesting to write, but I think also it just gives you that foothold when you're a reader. I think if you've got somebody that's invulnerable, that is just, you know, throwing out punches and striding through life, it's unrealistic in one sense, but it's also just inaccessible, I think, to the reader. But I think you've got to be careful with it, because if they're so vulnerable that they're no longer functioning properly, you know, one of my least favourite tropes in sort of crime fiction is the is the recovering alcoholic who lives in a caravan on a beach somewhere and goes home at the end of the day, drinks a bottle of scotch
and then gets a call going, there's one last case.
Yes.
You can redeem yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. So there, you can take it too far, I think, that sort of whole got demons thing. I mean, I like a character with demons, but I want them to be, I think what's truly heroic is if you are vulnerable, but you do something anyway. So if it doesn't scare you and you do it, it's not terribly heroic. But if you're doing things every day that require a lot of courage, if you're frightened of various things, or you repeatedly life knocks you down and you get back up again, that to me is what's heroic about a character.
You're right though about not going too far with it. I remember the Irish writer John Connolly telling me a few years ago that he'd read an American cop novel in which in the first scene the cop goes to a crime scene, and obviously the writer had gone, I'm going to show that my character is vulnerable and sensitive. So he sees this crime scene in the first chapter and wets himself. And John said to me, I just had to give up on the book at that point. I just went too much.
This is no way back.
There's no way back from that, isn't there? Yeah, so I just need to nip outside and change my...
Yes.
I think that's going a bit far. Belinda, you've not only written characters who are vulnerable, you've written from the point of view of vulnerable children. What kind of challenges did that present?
I don't think you can create a believable character, who's not vulnerable in some way.
Right.
And I have often concentrated on children, not in a sort of not intentionally to sort of create a more vulnerable character. I think the stories I've imagined have simply involved children in a central role. So that's how it's come up. But also, the children who are vulnerable in my books are also strong in many ways. And so I don't create vulnerable children to exploit that vulnerability. I create vulnerable children so they can overcome that vulnerability. And I think that's an important distinction.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying earlier, Sarah, about if we're writing characters who go through, you know, pain and grief and death and loss, and then just bounce back like nothing's happened. They're just cartoons, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
And they're not even cartoons these days. I mean, nowadays you go and see Marvel movies and everybody's bloody vulnerable.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Batman's vulnerable.
Logan.
I've just got to get out of this lycra. Logan. I've wet myself.
Yeah. Yes.
It's head in a plastic suit.
The incontinent superhero.
Yes.
What's your special skill? I can wet myself at will. That really puts the
super... In fact, I can't help it if
the supervillains just run.
Yes. From the
incontinental drift. You can see it now.
But in Rubbernecker, you made life even harder for yourself, I would suggest. I mean, that story is told from the point of view of Patrick, who's this medical student with Asperger's.
Yes.
Again, did that present a challenge? Did you have to do a lot of research for that book?
I did an awful lot of research for that book, but not as much as you might think as far as Asperger's went, simply because that was a matter of researching the parameters of that condition, which are quite wide-ranging, and then imagining Patrick as that person, so that every word that came out of his mouth had to be believable within the parameters of the condition. And it took me a few goes to to get it right, two or three starts at him. And then once I did, it was an incredibly easy thing to do, because I knew exactly, it was easier than writing an ordinary character who hadn't got Asperger's, because I knew exactly where his limits were. And by the end of the book, I envied Patrick so much, because he knew exactly where he was in life in so many ways, whereas all my ordinary characters in other books are still confused to this day, as am I.
But having inhabited that character so deeply for, I don't know, a year or a year and a half, 2 years, whatever, I mean, I'm going to come on a little bit later to talking about series and standalones and why you've taken the decisions you have, but was it hard to say goodbye to that character at the end of the book?
It was really hard. And it's the question I get asked most often is, when are you going to use Patrick in another book? And of course, because of his condition and B, the decisions I made in that book, it's very difficult to use Patrick in another book, because he's not a detective, he's not a scientist who's going to, forensic scientist. He really doesn't have a role that would involve him in repeat crimes. But I am determined at some point to do that.
Yeah, I think readers love that thing where a character that they've really engaged with perhaps just passes briefly through the narrative in another book and they go, oh, that was Patrick. Yes. That was Patrick.
Well, that's exactly the kind of milieu that I like to work in.
Yeah.
I don't write recurring characters. I don't write series characters. Yeah. But a lot of my books are developing this sort of world inside my head where all the characters I've ever created exist you know, coexist.
And they all find themselves in the same pub one night.
And they may all find themselves and their paths cross, because that's kind of like the reality of my universe.
Yeah. Now, Marnie, on the other hand, you know, she's a kick-ass heroine, doesn't take any shit, but, you know, deeply vulnerable, as we've just discussed. You once said that she was fighting against something that you described as the stigma of victimhood. I wonder if you could explain what you meant by that.
Yes, I think, well, she very keenly feels that she doesn't want to be a victim. She, for her job, as she sees it as a detective, is to help victims and to find justice for victims. But she's seen a lot of people very, you know, badly treated by life, who just basically are felled by the things that have happened to them and don't ever get back up again and don't ever fight on. And I think that's the horror in the back of her head, is that that might happen to her one day if she doesn't. So somebody whose parents are violently murdered in their own home by a 14-year-old boy who happens to be Marnie's foster brother, I think she lives on this knife edge where she feels she might fall from you know, her position of strength as she sees it, and never get back up again. That is the stigma for her, that you become... I don't think she necessarily feels that being a victim itself is a stigma, but I think she feels that what you let it do to you could potentially become stigmatizing. But again, because of the way that I'm taking her on this journey through the series, she's becoming softer as she becomes stronger. So she is, I think, less scared of falling, less scared of... And she was very brittle. So she seems to be very hard and kick-ass in the first book, quite spiky, quite angry, and quite unforgiving in some respects. Whereas by the time you've got to the fourth book, she's actually much softer and much more... gentle with herself and with other people. She opens herself up to people. She tells them secrets that could potentially, you know, turn around and bite her if she's told them to the wrong people. But she's much tougher, because I suppose it's the difference between being brittly hard and being sort of flexibly hard, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there is this idea that she has this empathy for the victims that she's helping because she has been a victim herself. And in the first book, she doesn't like that. She resents that necessity of knowing how it feels to be a victim. Whereas by the time we get to book four, she's actually learned how to make that pain into something positive so that she can be closer to those victims and help them in meaningful ways, as opposed to just feeling their pain.
That notion, though, of how trauma affects people, is that something... I know your grandmother was a Japanese prisoner of war.
Yes.
Now, is that something that she spoke about, something that you've, you know, taken on and taken in, and how that kind of trauma affects people?
Yeah, I mean, I oddly enough, my grandmother, who lived through the most, you know, horrendous 3 years as a young mother, so my mother was... just about 2 years old when the Japanese took them prisoner. So my grandmother and her husband and her child were taken prisoner. But she survived through that. She was, you know, if you'd ever met her, she was the least obviously traumatized. I mean, she was hugely funny, hugely courageous. She went back, after the war, she went to North Wales because she was advised to, because both she and my mother had suffered pneumonia in the camp. And she took any number of jobs. She, you know, she worked anywhere and everywhere to just sort of keep the family together. And it wasn't really, it's only through little snippets of things that I've found out since then that I realized how deep the trauma went. So she would always just say, if that hadn't happened to her, she wouldn't have grandchildren, you know, and she feels it was the making of her in a kind of way. But my mother told me fairly recently that it wasn't until about 2 years after the war that she knew for sure that her husband had died.
Oh, wow.
So for 2 years, because it was a chaos, of course, no one really knew, there were no graves, there were no records. So every time there was a knock on the door, she would think this was going to be it. This was going to be news of some kind. You would never, you know, never have guessed that if you'd met her, because she was so focused on being positive about the experience.
The things you're both talking about in terms of the way you approach your characters, the way you approach your stories, it strikes me that you'd be equally at home writing within straight down the line literary genre. So why crime? Why did you start writing crime fiction?
Oh, I fell backwards into it. It was not my intention. I didn't, you know, I wrote Blacklands, and it didn't occur to me for one second that it was a crime novel just because it had a serial killer in it. Because the serial killer was already convicted, he was in prison, everything had happened 20 years ago. I really wasn't familiar with the genre. I had no idea. And then when I went to sign a contract, and they said to me, well, what's your next, we'll give you a two-book deal, what's the second one going to be about? And I said, it's going to be about two children in a spaceship. And they said, no, it's not.
Can we have a word, Belinda?
Yes, exactly. I whipped that contract away from under my hand very quickly.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. And so
you've got to write that book, though. Is that still there, bubbling around in the back of your mind?
I know exactly what it's all about.
Patrick in a spaceship.
Yeah.
Two kids.
Patrick in space.
Amazing. But yeah, so I sort of did fall into it by accident. And at first I was a little bit resentful because I thought, well, I don't want to be restricted. And then I realised very quickly that crime is the least restrictive genre. It's the it's the widest of all possible genres. And also that almost every book anybody's ever read in the history of literature has got a crime at its heart.
I couldn't agree more. You're actually the first writer I've ever heard say that who I believed, saying, well, I wrote this book with a serial killer in it. I never thought it was a crime novel. You see people on panels and events all the time going, I'm not actually a crime writer. People go, but your book's got eight murders in it. What about you, Sarah? What drew you to crime?
Well, I'd always read, all my favourite books when I was growing up were crime books, and all my favourite TV dramas were crime, and my favourite films were either crime or horror. But I had this idea that I couldn't do plotting because I don't actually do plotting now. And until quite recently, I thought I was getting away with it and that I was doing it wrong. And that sooner or later, someone would go, now tell us how you plotted your book. And I'd have to go and make something up. But in fact, I discovered loads of people that write like the way I do and they don't plot it and it sort of happens organically. But it wasn't until a friend of mine said to me that what is plot anyway? It's just a series of coat hangers. But I've been thinking up until then, I've been thinking of it like this sort of a massive monster, you know, like how on earth could I grapple it like this sort of tentacled fiend? And when they just said it's a series of coat hangers, it became so mundane. I thought, you know what, I've got to give this a go. Now, it took me a few goes to get it right because with the non-plotting thing, it's a bit of an obstacle. But I think exactly what Belinda said. I think this huge scope, and you can go anywhere with a crime novel. You can go deep, you can go wide.
You can go funny, you can go dark.
It's a wonderful genre. And also it's subversive. I think it's the most subversive of all genres. I think if you're not subverting, obviously we subvert people's expectations because that's what we're doing with twists, etc. But if you're not being slightly subversive in your, in the story that you're telling, then I feel personally I'm not doing it right.
I think you can subvert. I don't mind subverting. The one I hate is transcending.
It's when people,
this is a book that transcends the genre. Because it's a perfectly good genre. It doesn't need transcending.
It doesn't.
But subverting is good.
Yes.
But you're both very different writers in one way, in that Sarah, you write a series so far, a series of novels. You write standalones or loosely linked standalones. What made you make those decisions? I mean, firstly, do you think you will take a break from the series at any point and write a standalone?
Yes, definitely. Fully intend to do that after that. So I'm writing Marnie Rome book 5, then I will write Marnie Rome book 6, and then at the moment. I mean, if I'm able to come back to it, I'd love to, but I'm absolutely panting to write a standalone. I just want that. I want so many people I've spoken to recently writing series that have taken a break and are writing a standalone. They say you go back to the series energized at the end of it. It's so liberating. I have to say, I love crime and I love the fact that, I love my detective team, but police procedural you'll know this, Mark. It's like you break off from the work of imagination. You're really there. You're right in the moment. And you realise you've got to go and research ballistic firearms residue. And it's a real,
Gotta be done.
I know, exactly. So, but I do sometimes I just think it would be lovely. The standalone I'm intending to write is going to be really, I think it might actually all take place virtually in one room. Not quite as closed as that. I've written some of it, and just the idea of not having to at any point stop and go and research anything because it's my world and I've got complete control over it. I'm finding quite exciting.
I guarantee though that when you're about halfway through that standalone you will think, why did I decide to do it? I could just be Marnie.
Yes.
Marnie. But that stepping out of your comfort zone is a brilliant thing to do. I think writers should do it. So what about you, Belinda? Are you panting to write a series?
Only financially.
Okay.
I know that's where people make a lot of money. People get invested in your series character and they buy a lot of books. But to be honest, I think I've almost got the best of both worlds, which is that, I don't feel restricted at all. But having developed these books where paths do cross And I have no compunction about bringing somebody from book three into book seven and, you know, and then doing a prequel and then doing this, that and the other with it. It doesn't bother me at all. I think it's fun for people to have those unexpected little pleasures. But I also have to say how much I admire people who can write a series, because I think that being able to settle down and start a new book and actually introduce your series character in a convincing way every single time without repeating the same thing and bringing all their history into the book, I mean, that really does put me off.
Bringing their history into the book without giving away stuff that's happened in earlier books is a tricky balance to strike.
Very, very difficult.
But I do think, actually, I think you might be slightly wrong about the whole sort of financial and commercial thing, in that I think the series used to be the Holy Grail, certainly within craft. I'm not sure it is anymore.
I don't think it is. I feel very much it's not. I think at the moment everybody loves standalones, it seems to me. But by the time I've written it and it's been published, who knows? Maybe I'll have missed the
magic moment. But it's that thing,
isn't
it? People pick up a book off the shelf and they go, oh, Marnie Rome 47. Oh, I haven't read the first 46. And they put it back. Yes. Whereas I think they read a standalone and go, I love that. And then they look at the front and go, oh, there's a whole series. Yes. You know, I think standalone. I'm the opposite of you. I really envy and admire people that write standalone after standalone. Because at least as writers of series, we have some kind of framework, don't we? We know that character is going to be there, and at some point there's going to be scenes with that character.
Yes,
and so
I recognise that. When I've reused characters, when I've recycled characters in my standalones, there is a lovely familiarity when I do reintroduce a character that I know I love and that readers love. I'm doing it in the book I'm writing at the moment, which is with Detective John Marvel. This is his first case in the West Country, having been disgraced up in London. But, so things like that, I really enjoy meeting him again and spending time with him again. But if you said to me, your next five books have to be about John Marvel, I'd kill myself.
Okay. Well, so before we wrap things up, what's next for you both? Obviously, Belinda, you're going to be writing Patrick in Space. But before that one, what is next for you both?
As soon as I finish the book that I'm writing at the moment, which is probably hopefully going to be on the train home from here.
Right, you're that close.
Then I immediately start researching the next book. I've got two in mind, and depending on the research, one of those I'll start writing in about August, September, that kind of
thing. But anything you can tell us about the book you're about to finish?
I'm just trying to remember what the book is that I'm about to finish.
The book you're about to finish.
Ah, yes, it's a prequel to Blacklands. John Marvel's very first case down in the West Country.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so
and that'll be out
near Exmoor.
Like a year from now?
It'll be out in November.
November this year?
I hope so.
Lord. Okay, and what's it called?
I haven't got a title for it yet.
Is that killing you?
I do have a title that I think my publishers will like, but if I say it and they don't like it,
then
I'm stupid.
Are you scared to tell them?
No, I think they'll like it. I'm just worried. I always hate to commit to a title unless I absolutely adore it, in case I think of something better before publication day.
Okay, so unnamed book will appear this November. What about you, Sarah?
Well, I'm not quite that close to finishing Marnie 5, but I will hopefully have finished it before Harrogate, because I don't want to be one of those authors that has to be in their hotel room desperately writing on my deadline.
At the Harrogate Festival. You want to be in the bar where you want to be.
Writing
in the bar, just surrounded by gin.
Yes, perfect. So that's called Come and Find Me. And it's going to be out in, I think it's something like the 9th of April next year.
Right.
And then as soon as I finish, virtually straight away, straight into Marnie Rome 6, which doesn't have a title yet, but I have actually already written the opening scene for it, which I never normally do.
Wow, okay.
But I just had an idea for the opening scene and I had to write it. So I'm seamlessly, hopefully, going to go straight for...
Five to six. And then,
with just Harrogate and some gin in between.
And then the standalone.
Yes.
Okay. So now, as promised, in each episode, we ask our guests to bring their recommendations for a good read and a good watch. Belinda, let's start with you. What have you read recently that you'd recommend to our listeners?
I haven't read anything recently. At all. I read non-fiction, mostly for research.
Okay.
But I, as far as crime goes, I used to really enjoy reading Jim Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
And so The Killer Inside Me.
There you go. I'm not arguing with that. And what about something you've seen recently on television? It doesn't even have to be recently. Something you think somebody needs to catch
up
on.
I'm very late with everything. If the whole world loves something, I refuse to watch it. Years or something. So I've only just finished watching Breaking Bad, and I couldn't recommend anything more highly than that.
Okay.
But I will definitely be watching Luther now that I've heard Sarah sell it so well to me.
Okay, well, there you go. So Killer Inside Me and Breaking Bad. What about you, Sarah?
Well, I've just loads of books I've read recently, but there's one that's coming out, but it's a reissue, so you can actually buy it now if you want. It's called The Hours Before Dawn, and it's by a writer called Celia Fremlin, who is a sort of British contemporary of Patricia Highsmith. So she was writing, this book is her debut, which came out, I think it's something like 1958, and it's just such a brilliant psychological thriller. It's about a new mother whose baby doesn't sleep. And so, whilst trying to make her baby sleep by walking at night with the baby in the pram around London, she becomes increasingly paranoid and starts to hallucinate. And or is she? Or is she? Are there footsteps behind her? And Faber are reissuing it in July, I think it is. It's got glow in the dark lettering on the cover of the book.
Oh, that's always good.
I think it's very cool. So that would be my book recommendation. And I've just watched an amazing documentary on Netflix called Casting JonBenet, which is just...
About the murder
yes.
of the... Yeah.
But it really is unlike any other documentary I've ever seen. And I think that it's a group of mainly amateur actors who are auditioning for the roles of, I suspect, a project that was never intended to be made, a film about the awful killing of JonBenet in America. But I think the whole project was always just casting JonBenet and that they just... led the people to believe that they were actually auditioning for something more. But it's extraordinary. It's very difficult to watch in places, but it's also just very, very unlike any other documentary I've seen. And the last 5 minutes of it are just sort of goosebump central. So
okay.
It's on Netflix. Definitely
right.
recommend
Some fine
that
recommendations there. I'm actually going to throw one in, which I don't normally do, which is a novel called Missing Presumed by Susie Steiner, which if you haven't read it, you really, really need to. One of the
Excellent.
Best. I mean, and it's a debut. Sickeningly
it is.
Good. and I'm also lucky enough to have read the next one that's coming out called Persons Unknown. Fabulous. Yeah. Missing Presumed by Susie Steiner. And that's about it for this episode of A Stab in the Dark. In this episode, what have we found out? Well, we've learned that the countryside and the city both have unique characteristics when it comes to crime fiction, that the theme tune to The Archers is far scarier than the theme to Psycho, no detective should wet himself at a crime scene, and we now know what to feed a chameleon. We'll be back again next time with more fantastic names from the worlds of crime fiction and crime drama, but in the meantime, you can find out more about A Stab in the Dark at uktv.co.uk/A Stab in the Dark, or get in touch with us on Twitter, #A Stab in the Dark. Plus, don't forget to review us on your podcast app. Your feedback really does make a difference. So if you like the show, please rate and review us. If you don't, keep your ill-informed opinions to yourself. And just a quick reminder, you can watch the best crime drama every day on UK TV channels Alibi and Drama. So with that, it's a huge thank you to my very special guests, Belinda Bauer and Sarah Hillary. And thanks to our producers, Paul Hirons, Joel Porter and John Lemon. My name's Mark Billingham, and thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.